Rick Smith.
So, day 25 of the strike at General Motors, as the UAW members still on the picket lines, and I've gotten a lot of responses over the past couple of days of, you know, people saying I'm surprised it's taken this long. The huge victory that they had over the healthcare issue. We should have, sent the message. A lot of stuff, and I keep telling people this could be a very get ready. Anytime you walk out of the picket line, it could be a very long strike. In fact, history has shown us that some of these strikes have gone on 60, 70 days. So we're at day 25. Buckle up. Anyway, I've got Dan Kaufman on the line. He's a journalist. He's written a great piece on the GM strike that's over at the New Yorker. He's also the author of the book, The Fall of Wisconsin, The Conservative Conquest of a Progressive Bastion and the Future of American Politics, one of the must-reads. Dan, thanks for taking time for us.
No problem, Rick. Happy to be on.
So here we are, day 25. Still, from what I'm seeing, what I'm hearing, lots of enthusiasm, lots of solidarity, lots of fight still.
Yeah, no, I don't think that the workers have lost any of their, speaking generally, have lost any of their enthusiasm for going out. I mean, these grievances, go back a long way, especially since 2007 when, GM introduced Tier 2 workers, which was ostensibly phased out, but then, kept in practice. I mean, you have people waiting 8 years to make the full wage, starting at half the wage, roughly. They have no pensions. That was phased out in 2007. And, this is a company that has that received, a $50 billion bailout from the U.S. government at that time. So they won a lot of concessions, and they've been very profitable since then, and there's just a sense that the workers, if they don't, kind of put their foot down here, they'll just keep taking and taking. And also, I think that, there's just been a general, kind of pro-labor mood in the country, even, ironically, as the number of unionized workers falls to its lowest point. But I think people are finally understanding the role that labor has always played as a check on corporate power. So that's also.
No, I keep saying that. I've been saying this for a while. I'm hoping that this is one of those moments where we, as a working class, say enough already. Because, as you point out, GM extremely profitable. What was it, like $35 billion over the last couple of years they've raked in profits. There's a lot of money there. And the fact that they're not wanting to share it with the people who actually produce that wealth is quite telling to me, while they're paying their CEO, an obscene amount of money every year. Just shows me where we are in this country. And I'm hoping that by having, this happen now, people will lift their head and go, hey, maybe this organizing thing, maybe this unionizing thing, maybe it's not as bad as we've been force-fed to believe that it is.
Yeah, I think there's some of that. I think my sense was that the union, both the leadership and the rank and file, sensed the pro-labor sentiment out in the public. And that obviously, makes a big difference as to how willing, workers are to go on strike and how willing the leadership is to call for a strike. I think also, too, as you mentioned, the corporate, profits, but also, they've GM is shifting a lot of production overseas.
Right.
And, Mexico, an auto worker there makes roughly $2.30 an hour. There's no independent trade unions there. And the legacy of NAFTA and these free trade deals continues to undermine, leverage that the unionized workforce in the States has. And the UAW is such an important kind of American institution beyond just for labor. I mean, going back to the civil rights movement, it played a key role as an ally to Martin Luther King, Walter Reuther, and so on. And I think it always saw itself and continues to see itself as something more than just fighting for decent wages for its members, but, fighting to improve the society as a whole. And I think, they see themselves. Some of the workers are really aware of their role and actually feel quite grateful to be have this opportunity to take a stand against this widening economic inequality that is nationwide.
You know? Now, you brought up Walter Reuther, and you know, obviously the three Reuthers,
right.
Who you know
right.
at the time, you know, were setting, you know, the conditions for, you know, not just across the industry, but across the country and for work in just about every industry, because as they were winning more and more, you know, better wages, better health care benefits, better retirement, safer working conditions, other places were being forced up as well. And that's been kind of the knock of the labor movement in the last 20, 30 years, is they haven't been that force for bringing everybody up as they were in the past. And a large part of that has to do with the fact that we aren't that same, you know, we aren't our grandparents' generation.
No, and I mean, GM was selling half the cars in the United States at the time of those contracts, and the UAW had, you know, more than a million members. So leverage is weakened, and why is it weakened? I mean, there's a lot of factors, but one of the big ones is these free trade agreements that have undermined, the UAW's strength and given GM leverage, and also, you know, foreign imports and a lot of other factors, but you're absolutely right. I mean, the Treaty of Detroit, this famous contract that Reuther signed in 1950, not only set the standard for the UAW and auto workers, the other of the big three, Ford and Chrysler as well, but for other industries. I mean, the idea that, the company would provide a pension and the company would give health care, and this all goes back to some of these contracts that the UAW negotiated at that time, and it set a very high standard. It ushered in, you know, the greatest period of working class prosperity in American history. And I think in a similar way, they kind of see their role, although they're fighting to reclaim stuff that's been lost, but they do, I think, they see this strike as really important, and it followed a lot of recent strikes that they're very aware of, like teacher strikes and so on, that were successful. And I think the sentiment among the public is that it's just gotten so far imbalanced, and so they do have a lot of popular support, you know, out there.
Yeah, no, but I think, you know, like the story that's been breaking the last couple of days that we've been talking about you know, the top 400 wealthiest people in this country
right.
paying a lower tax rate than everybody else.
Right.
I mean, we're clearly at a moment where I don't care what you do, you're looking around going, something isn't right. There's something wrong with this picture that...
Oh, sure. You know, and people are working longer hours for less money. And GM, you know, opened the negotiations. They wanted the workers to pay 15% of their health care costs, with now they pay 3 or 4%, and that's lower than the national average. But then you realize the national average is just eating away at people's earnings. It's 28%, which is crazy, you know, and that didn't used to be the case. And I think everyone is being squeezed. There's also fear of outsourcing amongst white collar people now too. You know, when you look at the layoffs that, in November of last year, Mary Barra, the CEO of GM, announced she was unallocating four American plants and closing a Canadian plant. But the bigger share of the layoffs were salaried workforce. 8,000 GM workers were laid off, were gone. And there's a real retrenchment. It's all about the shareholders, you know, and there's such tremendous pressure just to deliver every cent of profit to the shareholders. And that means, like, moving production overseas and so on and so forth.
But I thought the Business Roundtable said we weren't doing this anymore. I thought, you know, most recently the Business Roundtable came out and said it's no longer about maximizing shareholder wealth. It's about
we
now care about, you know, our employees. We now care, shocker of all shockers, we now care about the customer. It's no longer only about profit. Yeah. We now care about the workers and the customers.
Yeah, well, we'll see how that goes. I know I did see that they said that. Yeah, well, I mean, we'll see how these negotiations play out with GM. But yeah, no, I'm not yet convinced. And, you know, this goes back to the 70s, Milton Friedman and others. I mean, they basically, there were so many factors that go into the decline of unionization, but a big one has been this emphasis on shareholder value at the expense of all other considerations. And you look at, you know, Mary Barra's compensation package and so on and so forth. And And she was getting, I mean, she has more than 1 million shares of GM stock, you know, a few days after, as I wrote in my piece, a few days after she rescinded the health insurance of some 50,000 people, she was getting a check for $400,000, you know, a quarterly dividend check. That's just, you know, there's a real, the kind of compensation package and the incentives are just a very out of whack.
Yep. And you go back to the 1960s, you know, and GM was part of this. You know, the CEO made, what 20 times what the average worker made?
Right. Now we're 300. Yeah.
Now we're talking multiple hundreds. You know, my favorite one is the woman who's the head of Mattel, making 9,000 times what the average worker of her company makes, which is just completely outrageous.
Yeah. No. And I mean, I think there's so much anger. And I mean, I think it also feeds into some of the politically toxic environment that we're in right now. You know, I mean, this is something that was really pronounced in my book. You know, as living standards go down, there's a lot of, it creates a kind of petri dish for resentment. And Trump very effectively was able to use that, particularly noticeable in Wisconsin, where, you know, Walker had really decimated public employees and brought them to heel, really, and lowered people's living standards significantly. And there was a lot of anger. And when Trump came in and started blaming immigrants and so on, there was a really receptive audience to that. And it goes back decades, really, I mean, especially in rural communities, which have been hollowed out so much. And there's a lot of resentment. And this kind of resentment can really feed and grow in very dangerous ways when there's this declining standard, you know, and people get angry with each other, and really some of the culprits are kind of, you know, not as...
It's easy to scapegoat. Visible. No, I
yeah,
mean,
exactly,
I remember...
Exactly.
You know, I remember, you know, my grandmother passed away in April of 16, and I was back for the funeral. And when I came back, I then predicted that Trump was going to win the presidency because, quite simply, these people, you know, who had never voted in their lives, weren't politically active, were registering to vote for him because of the message. You know, because these are folks who, you know, grew up, they lived in Cleveland during the downfall of the industrialization.
Right.
All of those middle class jobs that were feeding into the Chevy plant and the Ford plant, they were all gone. All that stuff has been decimated. The steel mills that were roaring during the 60s and 70s all closed. And, you know, they're working harder and harder, as you pointed out, for less and less. And then pointing the fingers at the people behind them, you know, because they get Medicaid or they get food stamps and it's always the others.
Right.
Trump played that just as perfectly as you could play it to get those folks to forget everything else and cast their vote for him.
Absolutely. And, you know, going back to Reagan, I mean, he started doing that.
The welfare queen.
And the young buck getting, you know, very racially coded messages, getting a T-bone steak and so on and so forth. And in Wisconsin, you know, especially in the Rust Belt, a lot of times people on the coast don't realize the importance of these free trade deals to communities in these areas, and they're really aware of where these factories have moved to. And I remember driving around Racine, Wisconsin, and the mayor there was like, you know, I can point to this factory, that factory, none of them closed because of automation.
Right.
It was, you know, they went to Mexico, they went to China. And he, you know, positioned himself as an anti-NAFTA, and, you know, frankly, the Democratic Party had been very supportive. You know, Clinton signed it.
Bill Clinton was supportive of it. Look, you know.
Totally, yeah.
You know, as I said, it was birthed under Ronald Reagan. It was his idea of a North American, you know, agreement. It was fully negotiated under George H.W. Bush, and it was signed under Bill Clinton. So it was that seamless, that was an issue that they all agreed on. The only one who said there was going to be a problem was the guy with the big ears, who said, you know, giant sucking sound, and he was right. The crazy little guy was right.
Yeah, well, and you had people like Sanders as well voting against it, and there's an interesting video of Sanders in Congress saying, like, I think this is going to feed disenchantment with both parties. And you had people like James Traficant, a kind of Trump-like figure from Youngstown, a congressman from Youngstown around that time, who came out strongly against conservative Democrats that became Republican, came out strongly against NAFTA, and I think Trump, you know, kind of found that economic nationalist vote, and I think both sides have a faction of their party that's
sure.
against these deals. But
I'm against them.
Yeah, no, exactly. And but he was the nominee on the Republican side, and Clinton had Hillary Clinton had no credibility on that issue because she had supported them as well.
The TPP was going to be the gold standard.
Exactly.
And everyone saw that as, you know, just another NAFTA extension that would, again, cause us to lose jobs. And look, I remember Obama running for office on, you know, you could trust me. I'm not going to pass Colombia or Corus or Panama.
Right.
And what we get, Colombia, Panama, Corus, and ultimately almost the TPP. And this is one of the things I've said, you know, Trump picked onto the message that the labor movement had been talking about for years, which are these bad trade deals.
Right.
Only to find out that, you know, he was going to probably make them, I don't know, the new NAFTA is a little bit better, but not for workers.
No, not really better. Not in a significant way where workers also have a voice in the agreement itself. I mean, and Trump has been terrible for labor. I mean, you can look at the, you know, his appointments and so on to the National Labor Relations Board and so on. But he was able to twin that message of, you know, racial resentment with this kind of economic populism. He also, like, said he wasn't going to touch Social Security. That's been a lie and so on.
This president lied? Really?
It was an effective message, and it'll be interesting to see what happens in who the Democrats nominate to see who might oppose it. But there's a real tension around these things, and NAFTA continues to play out. I mean, GM last year became the largest auto manufacturer in Mexico, so it's definitely continues to have a role. And they, you know, the Blazer, which they relaunched a couple of years ago, they are manufacturing there. And meanwhile, at the same time, they've idled Lordstown, which has produced like millions of vehicles since it was opened. This is in near Youngstown, Ohio. And it's been, it's a really salient issue, I think, for Trump, who's gone there, and they're trying to negotiate this deal to sell the factory to a tiny electric battery company that's annual revenues were less than $1 million.
That plant's never going to be filled with a tiny battery plant. It's a massive facility.
It's 6 million square feet. And on top of that, you look closely at what, like, Trump is aware of the political importance of these jobs and so on. But when you look at, like, what he did at Carrier or the Foxconn deal in Wisconsin, it's a lot of mirage. I mean, and in fact, he, you know, kind of threatened both two local union leaders, Chuck Jones at the Carrier plant and Dave Green in at the UAW local 1112 in Lordstown, for challenging his narrative on about, you know, how many jobs he was saving and what was going to happen. And it's interesting because he really is aware of the political importance of, you know, these kinds of manufacturing jobs to his reelection prospects. I mean, somebody there told me in Youngstown when I was reporting a story about the idling of the plant that, you know, if it remains shut, they really wondered about his chances of winning Ohio. It's become such an important kind of metaphor for his tenure, really.
Well, of course, because he hasn't brought the jobs back to the coal fields because they're not coming back. Sorry, I hate to say that, but gas has killed coal in this country. It wasn't Obama. It was gas. He hasn't brought those jobs back. Manufacturing and the big industries has gone down. There's been some tick in other manufacturing, but again, that's mostly been automated. So, you know, this vision that he was bringing back the good old days that a lot of people went to the polls for, I don't think is going to be there for him this time around.
No, and look at those jobs themselves. I mean, it's the UAW that made those jobs good jobs. It wasn't. I mean, some of the new jobs that they're bringing back are, you know, the tier two GM worker makes only $17 an hour. I mean, it's like it was the union that gave the good wages and the pension and so on and so forth. It wasn't. They're not necessarily good jobs, and they become more like other jobs as the union, not just the UAW, but, you know, all these unions have diminished in strength, and the wages are down in, you know, manufacturing compared to what they were. And that's why people are willingly, you know, uprooting themselves, sometimes only seeing their families on the weekends to just kind of keep their pension. They may be 5 years out, you know, from their 30 years. These are the traditional GM workers, and they're, you know, it's a very hard thing to do when you're in your mid-50s, like driving, you know, and separated from your spouse and children. Some people have committed suicide. There's been many divorces, you know, but this is, there's only seven states in the U.S. now with GM assembly plants. That's down from 16 as recently as 2005. There's a lot fewer jobs.
Yeah, and I love to hear people say, well, we've lost jobs. We didn't lose them. We know exactly where they are.
Yeah. No.
But, you know, here's the thing. You brought up an interesting point. You know, those were, you know, pre-unions, those were hard jobs. They were, long, sun up to sun down, 6 days a week kind of jobs where people didn't last very long. They were made good family-sustaining jobs because they were made union jobs. And I argue all the time that, you know, we don't pine manufacturing coming back. We don't pine those jobs back. We pine unions.
I think that's right. Yeah.
You know, we want the say. We want the better wages, the better hours, the better conditions. And that comes back to policy for me.
Totally. And I think it's also more than even just those things. It's a sense of respect and self-worth that a sense that they have, people have a voice. And that, again, that was something I encountered on the picket line outside when I was in Lake Orion at a GM plant. There was just a feeling that they were also striking for some of the other workers that they don't have this opportunity to even say anything about the widening.
I'm hoping that's going to be the case here. I'm hoping that this is that kind of spark. Because everybody's watching this. This is the big one right now, where, you know, all the major news outlets are covering some of it. Are watching. So on the other side of it, if you're getting, you know, if you do win and you are able to restore some of the wages and some of the benefits and cut down on the five-tier wage structure that they've got, make those permanent temporary employees permanent. I think you're going to start to see people go, hey, wait a minute. Maybe there's something to this organizing thing.
No, I think it's big stakes on both sides. And I think that is one of the reasons it's proved difficult to settle, because I think both sides see it as a kind of defining moment. It'll be interesting to see. I mean, the union has definitely dug in. And when I was meeting with workers, there was really a sense that, we've given up so much. And again, in the context of trying to save the company, and now it's profitable, now's our turn to get a piece of it back. We'll see. But I think also GM is fearful because, you know, pattern bargaining goes back a long ways. And, you know, it would set the standard, not just for the auto industry, but as you said, I think it would send a signal to the public at large that that labor can, you know, mitigate some of these problems. You know?
Yeah, and maybe it sends a message to the other auto companies in the country who aren't unionized that maybe their workers go, hey, maybe we get what they got.
Yeah. Well, that would be interesting. Yeah. There's been some interesting votes in Tennessee and in
I'm excited. I'm excited about the future, especially if this goes well. But Dan, I appreciate you taking time for us.
Well, thanks a lot, Rick. I appreciate talking with you.
Outstanding article. I hope you'll come back again and talk to us real soon.
Anytime. I appreciate the call.
Good stuff, Dan Kaufman. Again, check out his article over at The New Yorker. We'll get links out. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America.